From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The former commander of the Bosnian Serb military, Ratko Mladic, will spend the rest of his life in prison. A UN tribunal at The Hague today found Mladic guilty in the massacre of about 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica during the Bosnian War in 1995. Mladic is appealing the conviction. The BBC's Anna Holligan joins us from The Hague. And Anna, Mladic has been called the butcher of Bosnia. He was in the courtroom today. Remind us of his role in the massacre.
His role in the massacre was pivotal, especially in Srebrenica. He was on the ground. This was a man who coveted the attention. He often encouraged, in fact, TV cameras to film him on the ground giving orders, and that was the case in Srebrenica. He was filmed a few days before the massacre reassuring the women that their husbands and sons would be fine as they were separated and put onto buses. And in fact, as we now know, more than 7,000 men and boys, some as young as 12 years old, were taken off and executed, and their bodies are still being recovered from those mass graves today.
Mladic's trial, it's amazing. It's been going on for 4 years. Hundreds of witnesses were called. Could you just talk about the scale of this tribunal?
Well, this is, in fact, the last major trial to be heard at this court. It closes its doors for good at the end of this year. In terms of the survivors and what this means to them, because, you know, watching Ratko Mladic in court today was typical. The behaviour he demonstrated was typical of the way he's acted throughout this trial. It's ranged from sneering at the charges, being combative with the judges, even at times trying to intimidate the people watching in the public gallery. So today was really no surprise that he stood and he challenged the judges and he had to be ejected from the court. But speaking to the survivors afterwards, there was one man, his name is Fikret Akic. He was detained in one of those concentration camps which were throughout Bosnia. And his image on the front cover of Time magazine came to represent all the horrors. His skeletal image came to represent all of the horrors that the men suffered, the men and women suffered. And today he filed out of the court as Ratko Mladic was taken away to start his life sentence. Fikret was outside sitting on this bench, tucking into a cheese sandwich and smiling in the sunshine. And that's really the enduring image of justice that the survivors hope will be remembered, the fact they're walking free and he will now spend the rest of his life behind bars. And they say that he will go down as a coward rather than a hero, as so many back home still consider him to be,
right,
because in those final moments, he couldn't stand up to the charges.
So for these victims of the massacre, of course, this is a very emotional, significant day. But you mentioned people back at home in Serbia. How is this reverberating there, especially in parts of the country where there is still a strong feeling of nationalism, still 20 years after the war?
There is. And the people who we've been speaking to today, for them, that's really actually one of the things that they consider to be the most important thing about this trial, that they hope back home people will now distance themselves from Ratko Mladic and all that he represented to a lot of Bosnian Serbs who still consider him to be a war hero, a freedom fighter. And they're also hoping that it will send a message beyond Bosnia to countries around the world that even though justice can sometimes take months, years, decades in this case, it will come eventually. And they're hoping that will be something that will be heard, not just here in The Hague, not just back in the region, but of course around the world as well.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan at The Hague. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you.
So, an historic conviction in Europe. Back here in the States, a conviction overturned. Here now's Dean Russell reports from Kansas City.
Outside the Wyandotte County Courthouse in Kansas City, Kansas, a crowd is gathering around 41-year-old Lamont McIntyre. He's easy to spot. Tall and gaunt with thick, black-rimmed glasses. His smile is enormous because after serving 23 years in prison for a crime he never committed, this is McIntyre's first day as a free man.
I don't even think it's words to describe that. I mean, the best way I can describe it is I felt human for the first time. I felt like I had my life back, so I felt pretty happy.
An organization called the Innocence Project says that between 40,000 and 100,000 people in American prisons did not commit the crime they've been accused of. But the number of exonerations is far lower, about 2,000 people since 1989. So McIntyre considers himself lucky.
I walked around the neighborhood the other day. That feels so good. Even the sun feels different out here. The air tastes different. Everything smells different. It's just different. Freedom has its own way of getting into your senses.
In 1994, when McIntyre was just 17, he was charged with gunning down two young men in broad daylight. The description of the suspect was sparse, but justice was swift. Later that day, Lamont McIntyre was in custody with a one-way ticket to prison.
For me, it was scary because I was by myself. I was 17. It was like everything, the nightmares are made of, or the worst thing you can think about, a place like that, is that more.
There were issues with the case. No evidence that McIntyre knew the victims. No fingerprints, no murder weapon, no motive. The case rested on just two eyewitnesses, but it was enough for jurors to convict.
I talked to a lot of people, talk shows, organizations.
Rosie McIntyre is Lamont's mother.
Nobody heard me. It was like my voice didn't matter.
But she knew her son was innocent. As a single mother in a poor black community, finding help was near impossible.
It broke me down. I had nervous breakdowns, not one, but two. I wanted anybody to know that he's not that type of person. I never gave up, though, so I finally found the right people, but it took years.
People like Cheryl Pilot.
I've been on this case for 8 years, and we've had two different Innocence Projects involved, several different investigators. It's really taken a village.
Pilot is a Kansas City attorney who was one of the few willing to answer Rosie's call. For years, she pored over documents and found evidence of police negligence or worse.
They did nothing to examine or analyze the forensics, didn't look for the weapon, didn't look for the getaway car. They were happy to rest on these incredibly brief, incredibly superficial, almost meaningless interviews that all told added up to 19 and a half minutes for a double homicide that could send someone away to prison for the rest of his life.
We need to be looking at our system of justice because it does not work.
Saundra Newsom is perhaps the least likely advocate for McIntyre. Her son, Danielle Quinn, was one of the men he was accused of killing. She says she knew it wasn't McIntyre because her family saw the whole thing happen.
How long did you know that he was innocent?
From the beginning. Don's father told me they got the wrong guy.
Newsom wanted to help find her son's real killer. She even vowed never to visit Danielle's grave until Lamont McIntyre was freed.
Lamont! When I say free, you say Lamont! Free!
Lamont!
Free!
Lamont!
2 decades and 3 failed appeals later, the call for freedom grew into a public roar. On October 13th, the county district attorney said he'd no longer contest McIntyre's innocence, and later called for an investigation into the Kansas City detective that led McIntyre's case. That detective denied any misconduct. For Rosie McIntyre, she's still thinking about the day her son came home.
That was the best feeling of my life, to see my son free, no more bars. I could just touch him anytime I want, hug him, love him.
Lamont isn't the same person he once was. He says while he loves his family, sometimes he feels estranged after missing so many important moments, including the death of his grandfather. And now, into his 40s, he says he's missed his window to have his own family. But he is ready for a new life.
It's challenging. It's different, but I'm getting used to it. I want to do the same thing everybody else do that's free. I want to figure it out. For one, I'm going to get in barber school, get my license. I've been cutting hair my whole life. I'm going to get a podcast, do a podcast. So I'm going to do that. And I'm just going to follow my heart, follow my spirit.
He'll be starting from scratch because while most states offer exonerees some compensation, Kansas offers nothing. He and his mother say that's okay.
whatever's meant for me to have in this life, whatever it is, like conversation-wise, I'm going to get what I need to get based on who I am and based on who I serve. You know, so God's going to take care of me like he always has, so I don't worry about it.
I already won my lottery. That's all I wanted, my child back. I'm all right.
Seeing the McIntyres' joy has also brought some comfort to Sondra Newsom, who hasn't had a chance to properly mourn her son.
For me, it was a give and a take at the same time. And I felt a bit, not jealous, but I don't know the word.
Have you been able to visit your son's grave?
Not yet. Because I know then when I do that, it's final.
Perhaps now, she will. For Here and Now, I'm Dean Russell, reporting from Kansas City, Kansas.
Actor Melissa Leo first made our radar in the 1990s TV show Homicide: Life on the Street as Detective Sergeant Kay Howard, making her way in a man's world.
Most of the people who kill are men, and most of the people who get killed are men. I'm surrounded by men solving crimes by men against men.
Then there was Melissa's Oscar-winning Alice Ward, the tough-as-nails mom and manager to boxer Mickey Ward in the film The Fighter. In this scene, her daughter suggests Mickey get a new manager.
Yeah, but Mom, maybe Mickey should try something different.
What are you doing opening your mouth in my kitchen? You owe me $200.
I said I was going to pay you next week.
I don't want another word out of you. That was last month you told me 2 weeks. Did you take sides against me in my own house? You owe me money?
You just don't want to mess with Melissa Leo. In the new film Novitiate, she plays the Reverend Mother, head of a cloistered convent in the early 1960s. The nuns are required to observe silence much of the day, as the Reverend Mother explains to teenage would-be candidates.
When you hear that bell at 9 o'clock at night, signifying the beginning of grand silence, that means you don't talk. Any questions? Put your hand down, sister. Postulants don't have questions. And you are free to go home.
But the silence and the women's dorm rooms or cells are easier than the budding sexuality the girls try to fight off. After all, they will soon be married to God. But then the Reverend Mother herself is devastated by the changes wrought by Vatican II. Without consulting the nuns, it downgrades them, and in a decade, a third would be gone. Melissa Leo joins us in the studio to talk about this terrific character, the Reverend Mother, and how she, a non-Catholic, found her. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. The idea of a nun, so back in a day when Reverend Mother made her choice in the, good golly, she's been 40 years in that convent. In 1920s, she makes a choice to go into the convent. Women didn't have very many choices.
Right.
And women of today, although they hear it spoken about, don't really understand that. But it was a bold choice to say, I will be a nun.
Right.
And I think that out of admiration for that, this is a character I've always wanted to play, perhaps not Reverend Mother as seen in Novitiate, but a nun. It's fascinated me.
You said, maybe Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
But this is a cloistered nun at a time when the church is about to, how would you characterize it, downplay. Well, in fact, in Vatican II, it says that sacrifice will no longer be seen as an act of love.
The main thing they say is that the marriage I have had for 40 years is nullified. It doesn't count. It means nothing. My relationship with God and Christ is like any other good Catholic's relationship with God and Christ. It's like finding out your husband has another wife and family in another town. The insult in that is just horrifying.
The emotions ensue. It's funny. I think I read somewhere that you said that you thought initially that it would be sort of like the nice Mother Superior, but I'm thinking Sound of Music.
I can't deny that shooting the film was very difficult for me because it was clear it was a very different woman that was being put in the can, as we say.
Who is she? Is she mean? I mean, there's scenes where she's brutal.
People have said throughout the press tour all kinds of things, that they're terrified of her, that they, ha, 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 reminded of those awful days in Catholic school, ha, ha, ha. And that Reverend Mother is hurt by that.
Tell us more about Reverend Mother things. She was trying to uphold...
Reverend Mother says at the beginning of the film, I will be the voice of God. Mm-hmm. It is with utter respect, a respect most human beings cannot understand that she has for God, that she's explaining to these children, teenage girls, that are about to, you know, make this bold, brave choice. Do they know what they're getting into, or is it, as the film also tells the story of, sort of a young girl's fantasy to be a nun?
Do I understand that you stayed in character?
No. Just an actor doing my work. There was a motel in town, I'm sure, quite decent. But I found myself much more comfortable when I found out there was a dormitory room available on the campus that we were shooting. And in that way, yes, it kept me close to my character.
I thought it would be to keep that kind of tension between you and the young girls, because they are, you can see
no,
it.
No, that
it's
was
palpable.
Something nobody needed to act. I'm an actor that those young girls had a reason to respect. So our relationship in reality aided and abetted our relationship in the film.
She's got an Oscar, they would say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in that same way that they might whisper in the corners about me and then act a little different when I walked into the room, that's a response those young women are having to Melissa, and it works for the response the young postulants are having for Reverend Mother.
Yeah. Speaking of your Oscar, now I may have all of this wrong, but do I understand that you created your own wimple out of something that you wore at the Oscars?
It's just the truth, right? As I was leaving to go down to play Reverend Mother with the 2 weeks notice that I had that I was going down to do it, that white cloth was one of the things that I'm packing my trunk to get on the road because the show's going to start. Mm-hmm. And I throw in what instinct tells me I might need. But when I saw what the wimples were that were being designed, I didn't feel it was confining enough. And I thought, well, maybe this will work. And I used that.
I love that touch. And another element here, we talked about Vatican II and this Mother Superior seeing all these changes come. And there's one scene where she has a meeting with the Archbishop who's come to talk to her about it. And in this, you see she's something of a feminist. What she's fighting for is the rights of her fellow female nuns that she sees eroding. Let's listen to this scene where she's addressed like a child by Denis O'Hare as the Archbishop.
Tell me, what exactly are you having the most difficulty with? Just lay it all out for me.
I have no difficulty. I just happen to disagree with it, all of it. Not to mention, it's a slap in the face that the sisters weren't given any voice in the matter.
You honestly expected them to have their own voice, the sisters?
We are a part of this church, too.
Marie, that's not how it works.
I don't think you really understand what this will do to us. If we were to truly embrace all these changes, it will ruin the very institution of Catholic nuns as...
And he gets up and ends that conversation. It's hard to watch this movie without seeing what happened to the church decades on, many would say, because they didn't listen to the women in the church.
Well, isn't it interesting? That is about the time that that affront to all the young male students by the priests began really happening, mm-hmm. now that we look back on the records. Mm-hmm. And without the nuns in the house, it makes me wonder if it's even a part of why they excused the nuns from the room.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, you've been on this tour. Are there Catholics who are... I don't know. You're
absolutely.
You, yes.
Say the word.
Offended.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. I have spoken to several nuns at this point, nuns that have showed up at Q&As and walked out because of feeling greatly offended by it.
Why,
especially the sexuality. And as a female actor in this industry, I too am offended by the sexuality in the film.
There's just a couple of occasions where young girls are seen finding their sexuality. Often it's sneaking up on them in surprising ways in the early morning hours. But don't you need that to get across what they are giving up?
Not in my opinion, no. I think there's plenty of sexuality out in the world to kind of get that idea without going into these women's cells. And if there was one such story in the film, that would strike me as a different thing. But there are four such stories in the film, And that makes it sound as if all the nuns are doing this.
I feel like the Mother Superior is speaking to me right now.
It is. And once again, it's the line crossing. I'm a female actor.
Yeah.
And in the world today, I'm so sorry, Robin, but I am deeply offended. Yeah. It's a really bad scene right now,
yeah.
This power and control
over
others.
I want
to
ask you about that. I
mean, crazy, crazy times.
Watching this movie, you know, that could be Harvey Weinstein lecturing an actress or something and seeing that scene with the Archbishop.
Yeah. And the power and that sort of, you know, wielding of control. In another world, maybe the Archbishop could have said, well, Marie, perhaps we need to go to Rome. You've been living this life all these years. Let's go and see, you know, in another planet.
Hey, can I ask you, I also see such similarity between the Mother Superior and the Mother and the Fighter, one of my favorite characters. You got a little bit of criticism for actively campaigning for the Oscar. You took your own ads out. I applauded you because studios pick favorites.
When I had asked the publicists again and again and again, couldn't I get a glossy picture on the cover of a magazine? Because they kept on saying Oscar around me. And I don't think a woman can get an Oscar without a glossy picture on the front of a magazine. Mm-hmm. And besides which, it's all about more work for me.
Right.
I'm not in it for awards. I'm an actor. And the byline I said was simply, consider. And what I was asking my community out in Hollywood to consider was Melissa Leo as a movie star. Hire me for the next picture. I don't have to just play down and out trailer trash and mean old wicked old nuns. I could play a princess or a queen. That's all I wanted to do. Because campaigning does go on. It's a part of selling the film. It's a part of me sitting here talking to you now. Why do we have to pretend we're not in the sales game? I didn't sign on to be a salesman. I signed on to be an actor.
And, of course, people are whispering Oscar again, but we'll just move on to...
I didn't hear that. What?
Okay,
I
right.
I something in my ear.
That's Melissa Leo, star of the new film, Novitiate. Melissa Leo, thank you.
Earlier this week, the Treasury Department announced a fresh wave of sanctions against North Korea over its nuclear weapons program. And it comes at a time when the U.S. is increasingly using economic sanctions to rein in rogue regimes. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
This latest round of sanctions targets half a dozen North Korean trading and shipping companies. The Treasury Department also imposed sanctions on several Chinese trading companies. What the Trump administration is trying to do here is choke the flow of money that helps Pyongyang develop its nuclear program. It's doing so by using secondary sanctions, going after individuals and companies in other countries that knowingly do business with North Korea, especially in China.
The perception, reasonably so, is that without Chinese dealings with North Korea, that would really put a squeeze on the North Korean economy.
Stephen Heifetz is a Washington lawyer who has worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations on foreign investment issues.
China and Chinese businesses are right in the crosshairs for secondary sanctions.
Heifetz says so far, the Trump administration has been focusing on Chinese individuals and companies, but it appears to be inching towards sanctioning large Chinese banks. He says that would be a game changer.
If the Chinese bank is on the U.S. sanctions list, large institutions around the globe are likely to stop doing business with that Chinese bank.
I think that they probably would call our bluff on that.
Anthony Ruggiero, a North Korea specialist with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, says sanctioning Chinese banks could backfire. Beijing could retaliate, impose its own sanctions on U.S. banks, fuel a trade war, something not lost on the Trump administration.
What I think is likely going on inside the administration is this internal debate on what happens next. And that's one reason it hasn't happened.
The Trump administration's increasing use of sanctions against North Korea is part of a broader strategy to curb bad behavior by rogue nations. Think Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and now possibly Myanmar. Juan Zarate is the author of the book Treasury's War, He says economic sanctions have become an increasingly important strategy for the U.S.
Overall, these are sanctions and measures intended to coerce, intended to change behavior, and ultimately to affect the bottom line of the actors that are being targeted.
The U.S. has led the way in the use of sanctions since the Second World War, according to Gary Hofbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He studied sanctions for 3 decades and says he's seeing a marked increase in their use over the past few years.
These days, it's almost essential to use economic sanctions when you have a disagreement with a foreign country. Prior to doing anything in the military or even the covert operations sphere.
Hofbauer says the use of sanctions succeeded in bringing Iran to the negotiating table. But he says the effectiveness of sanctions is mixed. They've led to regime change in Latin America and parts of Africa. But historically, sanctions don't work on dictatorships.
It's really hard to get autocratic governments to change with the use of sanctions. And, you know, there's no autocracy which is more autocratic today than North Korea.
And Hofbauer says now more countries are following the U.S. and using economic sanctions, including Russia, the European Union, and China. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
I have a new favorite commercial. You might have seen it. Young adults approach a porch. There's grandma and grandpa coming out with, what's that, laptops?
At Ally Bank, no branches equals great rates. It's a fact. Kind of like grandkids equals free tech support.
Oh, Lord. Oh, look at you. So great to see you. None of this works. Come on in.
As the grandparents hand over a pile of tablets and phones to the kids, Pew Research says smartphone ownership among adults 65 and over has jumped 24% over the last 5 years. And there might be no better time for tech-savvy young relatives to give those adults free tech support than while the turkey is cooking tomorrow. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. He joins us in the studio with some tips. Ben, I so love that ad. I know you saw it, too. It's perfect, isn't it?
Yes, it feels very, very close to home.
Okay, okay. So talk about smartphones, e-readers, tablets.
Yeah.
What are the biggest problems and how do you best help someone?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of problems that happen, Robin, that are relatively small. Maybe it's a setting that you've toggled by mistake or something that's popped up that's an error on your computer. And I wanted to say 2 things about how you tackle this with a relative. First off, be patient with the person you're helping. I know that sounds obvious, but it's really important.
There's not a lot of patience on Thanksgiving in general.
That's right. Yeah. So, like, sit down, crack a beer, you know, like, take your time with this person you're helping. The other thing that helps a lot when you know how to fix the issue someone is struggling with, especially if it's something as simple as a setting, is to have them change it.
Yeah.
That way they'll remember it more easily if they face the issue again after you're gone.
That's so important. You don't want to just give them fish. You want to teach them how to fish and make their fingers actually do it.
Exactly. And there are other things that you can do as well, even after you're gone. For instance, there are a lot of remote desktop clients and apps. So I use one that's in Chrome, the browser. It's Chrome Remote Desktop. And what it allows you to do is connect to any number of computers, but your relative's computer in this case, and help them over the phone.
This is so
great. If it
pops
up.
This
yeah.
is like when you call Apple, they ask if they can take over your computer,
yeah.
for instance. You'd be able to do it with a relative. Windows has a remote assistance app. So you'd become pretty much an administrator, just like your relative is.
Just work out your hourly rate ahead of time.
Might be privacy issues, so make sure everybody understands that you can get in. That's
sure.
fantastic. Okay, what if you aren't doing that and you really don't know the answer? You're not a technical whiz. What do you do?
Yeah, so one of the really good things about the time we're living in is that almost any problem you can face with technology, someone else has already faced it and put the answer on the internet. So go back to the internet. First things first, you can just Google it or Bing it. I don't know if anyone says Bing it, but put in some specifics to your search terms, the specific model of the device, for instance, a good description of the problem. If you're getting a specific message, like an error message, put that exact language into your search terms, and you'll get often the exact problem will pop up an answer to that problem. 2 resources I also use a lot are YouTube. any number of problems you can imagine. You can find brief, very simple explaining videos on YouTube. You can also look on Reddit, actually. Reddit has a ton of very specific communities. Often they'll be around a piece of technology or device, and you can find the answer on Reddit.
This is a community kind of message board where people can gather together. Okay.
Yep. And lastly, if you're trying to fix a broken screen or some other issue with the hardware itself, there's this great website called iFixit. It's this kind of amazing crowdsourced collection of repair manuals and instructions for tons of devices, and it's made by users and updated by users constantly.
So some people are listening and saying, no, the last thing we want at Thanksgiving is technology.
Yeah.
We want that thing that turns everything off. But how can technology maybe bring people together?
You know, I think we're all trying to unplug around the holidays to a certain degree. At least I am. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that I really love are these HDMI streaming sticks that are popular now. So you've got your Amazon Fire Stick, you have your Google Chromecast, and you also have Roku. All of these options, they're really cheap. They're like $40. You can pick up one on the way home. And you can plug it into your TV and you can stream video and music. And in the case of Chromecast, you can actually project whatever is on your phone onto the TV screen. So
like
if you want to show, photos, family photos, video of
but
the
be
new
careful.
Babies. Yeah, of course. You want to be, know what's in your camera roll before you do that. And I just love these streaming sticks because they're really easy to use. They're easy to set up. And there's this Arthur C. Clarke adage about sufficiently advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic. I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase, but
it's lovely.
Yeah. And I feel like streaming sticks are kind of that. They kind of hit that bar for me. There are also some apps that you can, there are quiz apps. There's an app called Quiz Up that you can actually play with family members. You can all download the app and kind of play trivia. And that can also be fun.
Look, Black Friday, Cyber Monday shopping coming as well. Mm-hmm. Is Consumer Reports still the go-to?
I hate to say it. It is. Well, I don't hate to say it. It's like got a long storied history of being, really comprehensive, doing a lot of really, really aggressive testing on products. There are some upstarts of a kind. CNET is one. I use CNET a lot. It's pretty comprehensive as well, and it'll do these kind of roundups. So if you have a relative who's really interested in the smart home, for instance, mm-hmm. you can go to CNET and find a really comprehensive list of different smart home devices. And I'm a big fan of Wirecutter. This is a site that was bought actually in 2016 by the New York Times for over $30 million. It feels like there's this element of curation on Wirecutter that there isn't on these other two examples I've given. And that's kind of nice when you feel sort of overwhelmed, as many of us do when we're trying to find the gadget for our relative that they're into, but we may not know where to
right.
look for.
And so they curate them for you there.
Yeah.
Wirecutter, now with the stamp of the New York Times on it. So there's that. Ben Johnson, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Robin.
Well, there's a chance a lot of families and friends gathering tomorrow will be sharing memories of teen heartthrob David Cassidy, who died Tuesday night of liver failure at the age of 67. After his initial huge success in the 70s, he didn't necessarily like the title teen heartthrob. NPR's Chris Benderev reminds us he tried to remake himself.
If you only remember David Cassidy a little bit, there's a good chance that's because of this song. It was the biggest hit for the band made famous by its own TV show in the 1970s, The Partridge Family. The song's called I Think I Love You. It featured a young David Cassidy's vocals, and it made teenage girls fall in love with him. Cassidy was born in 1950 in New York City, the son of two performers, Jack Cassidy and Evelyn Ward. After his parents divorced, his dad married singer and actress Shirley Jones. And Jones would go on to portray David's mother on The Partridge Family, which debuted in 1970. The show's about this musically talented family led by their widowed mother. She drives them around in a big brightly colored bus, pursuing fame.
All right, kids, this is Vine Street. Battle stations, everyone.
The show was a hit, But the vibe at a moment of counterculture was definitely family-oriented.
Hello world, hear the song that we're singing. Come on, get happy.
Ann Powers, who's a music critic for NPR, was totally into David Cassidy at the time.
I don't know, he was like, he just had a sexy thing going on that appealed to teenagers, you know, and his vocals were kind of husky and emphatic.
The 1950s had been a big decade for teen idol music stars. Then, in the 1960s, it became more about bands who wrote their own music, like the Beatles and the Stones. By the 1970s, Ann Powers says, a new generation of teens were ready for Cassidy.
David Cassidy, like, really re-energized the teen idol industry. You know, there were magazines, there was obviously the TV show.
After the TV show became a hit, Cassidy seemed to want to shed his good boy image. And he did that most memorably in 1972 when he posed semi-nude for Rolling Stone.
You could see a little pubic hair, so that was quite scandalous.
After the show ended in 1974, Cassidy had a moderately successful solo music career. As an actor, meanwhile, he wanted different kinds of roles, but he felt typecast.
They're merchandising your name and your face and your likeness, and I felt kind of robbed of my identity.
This is David Cassidy speaking to NPR in 1981.
There was a time when I stopped working. I left the business for about three and a half years. I just found myself pretty much a recluse.
David Cassidy moved on to theater in the 1980s. And later, in the 2000s, he went public about his struggles with alcohol and drugs. 2 years ago, he went bankrupt and was also involved in a hit and run. And then, earlier this year, he talked openly about his decline into dementia. David Cassidy is survived by two children and his stepmother, Shirley Jones. Chris Benderev, NPR News.
Pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of the disease. It's difficult to detect and it's difficult to treat, but recent discoveries are helping researchers better understand it. Meghna Keshavan covers biotech for our partners at STAT, and she joins us now. Hi, Meghna.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. You know, just 20% of patients survive a year after their diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Why is it so hard to treat?
Well, it's very, very difficult to detect, and that's because symptoms don't tend to show up until the cancer is really far progressed. So doctors don't usually know that a person has pancreatic cancer until it's stage four and it's spread through the whole body.
Scientists have found recently, and you write about this, that bacteria might affect how a tumor in a pancreas grows. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So we're learning more and more about how all the billions of bacteria in our body are just impacting our everyday function and the way that, you know, our cells work. And one of the things that they're seeing is that there is a bacteria in many pancreatic tumors, probably about 76%, that actually breaks down chemotherapy. So it works by protecting the cancer against chemotherapy drugs by disabling chemo. And only a small fraction of chemo drugs work at all in pancreatic cancer drugs. And one of the ones called gemcitabine is actually targeted by this bacteria. So it's a really interesting area of study on understanding why drugs aren't working and maybe ways to optimize how you could make them work better by tweaking the bacteria.
Right. So what's next for researchers as they try to figure out how to use this new knowledge about the bacteria?
Well, it's a little complicated. It's not something as simple as saying, hey, we'll give you an antibiotic and a chemotherapy and the bacteria will get killed. It doesn't work like that because some bacteria is actually very good for warding off cancer. So what they're trying to do is isolating which bacteria causes the problem. And then from there, try and figure out ways to create drugs maybe that will target that specific bacteria, but not the rest.
Yeah. The pancreas, it's a part of the digestive system. It helps to regulate blood sugar levels. And so there's an interesting connection here, possibly with diabetes and pancreatic cancer. What about that?
First off, I do have to say millions of people have diabetes, and the vast majority, I'd say probably more than 99% of people with diabetes do not have to worry about pancreatic cancer. But there's a really, really small sliver of people where they're seeing a link between the pancreatic cancer and the diabetes, and they're not entirely sure why. So there's a consortium of researchers around the country and the National Institutes of Health looking at 10,000 patients who have diabetes and sort of tracking them to see which ones develop pancreatic cancer and which ones don't, so that maybe they can end up with a diagnostic test that could help doctors figure out if a person has pancreatic cancer earlier in the game so they might be able to treat it better.
Smoking and obesity, we know those are risk factors for pancreatic cancer as well, but there's also a genetic link. What do we know about the genetics in this disease?
We know that some of the pancreatic cancers can have a genetic link, like it can somewhat run in families. What researchers are now starting to understand, too, is the genetics of survival. Carrying certain gene mutations can actually help your odds in surviving a certain cancer, like certain mutations in the cancer itself, whereas other types of cancer mutations are just a lot harder to treat. So doctors are just learning about which ones are the more treatable cancers.
You know, in other cancers, thinking about skin cancer, for instance, we've seen a lot of developments lately over the past few years with immunotherapy, using our own immune systems to fight the disease. It sounds like there's been some progress with pancreatic cancer in that field. Are we just in the early stages there?
We are in the absolute earliest stages of immunotherapy. Until about a week and a half ago, there was absolutely no evidence that immunotherapy worked at all.
Huh.
But a small study that was presented at a conference last week basically indicated that immunotherapy might have an impact. Like, there's a combination of experimental drugs that might actually make some headway in pancreatic cancer. And when I say that, I mean that I think it was 4 out of 31 patients studied showed some sort of a response to immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. So it's modest, but it's really promising because immunotherapy works in so many different cancers at this point. So
it's modest, but maybe hope for a disease that, as we've said, is very deadly. It can take people very quickly, sometimes within a month of a diagnosis. It's also the third leading cause of cancer-related death in the United States. So if you take all of these pictures that we've just painted in each of these categories, what should we say about, you know, the future of treating this disease and our hope for getting a handle on it?
It's really early to tell, to be entirely honest. But pancreatic cancer, I mean, the survival rates have barely budged in 40 years. You know, a lot of cancers have double, tripled their survival, and pancreatic cancer really has not. But now that we're learning more, there's a lot more focused research and attention and understanding of the disease, and that always can help develop better therapies.
Megan Akeshavan is a biotech correspondent for STAT. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.